It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Hong Kong protesters ignore ultimatum. U.S. Ebola patient fighting for his life. I'm Ray Kugel reporting from Washington. Major streets in Hong Kong remain blocked this morning as pro-democracy activists ignored an ultimatum from leader Leung Chun-ying to leave their protest sites. There's been no sign of an imminent crackdown by the police. Late Sunday, the protesters took down some of the barricades that they had set up near the government headquarters last week in a move aimed at allowing civil servants to return to work. Protester Do Chan was defiant.
I'm against any kind of withdrawal or the tendency to surrender. I think withdrawing, I mean, shaking hands with the police is a very ugly gesture of surrender.
Tens of thousands of Hong Kong residents have been staging around-the-clock protest on the street since last Sunday, demanding a right to choose the candidates for the city's next leadership election in 2017. The condition of the Liberian Ebola patient hospitalized in the southwestern state of Texas is getting worse. Thomas Eric Duncan changed over the weekend from serious to critical. Dr. Thomas Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control told CNN's State of the Union program Sunday Duncan is fighting for his life, and that finding everyone who had contact with him will help prevent the spread of Ebola.
The bottom line is that we're stopping Ebola in its tracks in Dallas. We're working throughout the U.S. to increase the level of tracking for any possible cases so that if other patients come in, they can be promptly isolated. And we're continuing to surge the response in Africa to stop Ebola at the source so that we don't have to deal with it in the coming years.
This is VOA News. Somali officials say about 1,000 Somali forces and African peacekeepers have retaken the southern port of Barawi, the last major port held by Islamist al-Shabaab fighters. The key port, located 240 kilometers south of the capital Mogadishu, have been held by al-Shabaab since 2008. The insurgents control the port to export $25 million worth of charcoal a year to Persian Gulf countries, which they use to fund their fight against the internationally backed government. The murder trial of a British millionaire accused of ordering the killing of his wife while they were on honeymoon in South Africa is scheduled to begin today. 34-year-old Shirin Diwani is accused of hiring hitmen to murder his wife. He denies any involvement. Anna Diwani was shot dead in Cape Town in November 2010, just days after the couple's wedding in India. The anger of Turkish Kurds is mounting over the plight of the Syrian border town of Kobani, besieged for weeks by jihadists. Jamie Detmer reports.
They've come from Kurdish towns from across Turkey to express solidarity with fellow Kurds in Syria. Along a 20-kilometer stretch of the border, they watch the battle rage in nearby Kobani. Mayor of the town of Batman, Sabri Ozdenish, is among the hundreds of Kurds on the border. He says if Kobani falls, Turkey will fall, meaning the already faltering peace process will be ended by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. The Islamic State jihadists, who have modern tanks and weaponry captured from Iraqi forces, outgun the Kobani Kurds. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Surak.
At least 16 fighters linked to al-Qaeda's Syrian wing, the Nusra Front, were killed Sunday after clashing with Hezbollah forces near the Lebanese border town of Arsal. Two Hezbollah fighters were also killed in the encounter, the latest spillover from the Syrian civil war. The month-old ceasefire exists in name only at the Donetsk airport in eastern Ukraine, with some of the fiercest fighting of the six-month war erupting Sunday between Kiev's forces and pro-Russian separatists. Artillery blasts rocked the skies. Ukraine's military accused the rebels of new violations of the ceasefire. Kiev says two of its soldiers were killed in the latest fighting and another six wounded, while the separatists said three of its fighters were left dead and 32 wounded. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff finished first in Sunday's presidential election, but she failed to win the absolute majority needed to avoid a runoff later this month. With almost all of the ballots counted, Ms. Rousseff had just over 40% of the vote, while pro-business Social Democrat Aécio Neves had about 34%. A second-round runoff election will be held October 26th. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The condition of the Liberian man considered the first diagnosed Ebola patient in the United States is said to be critical.
I'm quite concerned. The longer this goes on in these three West African countries, the greater the possibility that other countries in Africa are going to have to fight this on their territory as well.
Dr. Tom Frieden is director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Liberian journalists accused their government of trying to restrict their coverage of Ebola-related news. African Union and Somali troops recapture a key port city from Al-Shabaab. And South Sudan's on and off again peace talks have again adjourned.
What has happened is that the negotiators have been asked to go back to their principles to consult on some of the issues where there is some concurrence.
Barnaba Marat Benjamin, South Sudan's foreign minister, frustration breeds violence in South Sudan's IDP camps, and Senegal takes a technology approach to women's education. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The condition of the Liberian man considered the first diagnosed Ebola patient in the United States is said to be critical. Thomas Eric Duncan, who arrived in the United States from Liberia 2 weeks ago, is in isolation at a hospital in Dallas, Texas. Meanwhile, America's top disease prevention official said on Sunday he remains confident the United States will not experience a significant outbreak of Ebola, but that containment in Africa is critical to reducing risk everywhere in the world. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Washington.
At present, a Liberian man in Dallas, Texas, is the only confirmed active Ebola case known in the United States. But swift responses to recent false alarms show a national medical community on high alert, including the mobilization of a disease control unit to meet an incoming international flight on which an African man had become ill, as it turns out, with something other than Ebola.
Our top priority is the safety of Americans.
The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Tom Frieden, says there is no cause for panic.
Here in the U.S., I remain quite confident we will not have a widespread outbreak. We will stop it in its tracks because we've got infection control in hospitals and public health that tracks and isolates people if they get symptoms.
Ultimately, Ebola must be controlled at its source.
I'm quite concerned. The longer this goes on in these three West African countries, the greater the possibility that other countries in Africa are going to have to fight this on their territory as well. We have to recognize that try as we might, until the outbreak is controlled in Africa, we can't get the risk here to zero.
The United States has dispatched military and civilian personnel to West Africa to help combat the virus, which has claimed more than 3,000 lives in recent months. Meanwhile, some African immigrants in the United States say they fear being shunned if the public's apprehension about Ebola escalates to widespread panic.
Just being a black person or just being a citizen from Africa does not mean you have Ebola.
Ebola is transmitted by direct contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person or corpse. Symptoms appear in 2 to 21 days after infection. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
The Press Union of Liberia is calling on the Liberian government to concentrate its energy on fighting the deadly Ebola virus outbreak and stop trying to prevent journalists from doing their work. This comes as the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare has released a new media policy requiring journalists wanting to photograph, conduct interviews or do video recordings at an Ebola healthcare facility to first get a written permission from the Health Ministry. Assistant Health Minister and head of the Ebola Incident Management Team, Talbert Nyeswa, said the new media access policy aims to protect the privacy of patients and healthcare workers. But Press Union of Liberia President Abdoulaye Camara says the new policy shows the government is avoiding the real work it must do in mobilizing resources to fight the Ebola outbreak.
We find it very offensive. There are two things we notice in here. Firstly, the government functionaries probably don't understand the context of free expression. They are actually working in contempt of the media, which is not in the best interest. It doesn't answer the initiatives that media has been developing in fighting this Ebola virus in our country.
Mr. Nyasio of the Ministry of Health, he is saying that the new policy is intended to protect the privacy of patients and the healthcare workers, and to protect health and safety of both Liberians and international journalists. What do you make of that?
A few journalists have had access to the treatment center. I know a number of friends who have done videos or audio recording from there. But it's like, it's always a carefully planned thing. The further truth is, a lot of people who are alleged to be suffering from the Ebola virus are not actually in hospitals. And a lot of the stories that reporters are carrying are not really coming from hospitals. So does the government have the capacity to stop people from going to Banjul to speak to suspected cases there? Or do they have the capacity to stop people from going to 72nd to speak to suspected cases there? These are a lot of sick people who are not even in health facilities. So I think the government is avoiding the real work they got to do to try to mobilize resources from the communities and from partners to fight this thing. And they are trying to fight another perceived enemy who is actually not an enemy. They're fighting the media. And that is being expressed in different ways. For the last 10, 15 years, or 21 years, successive governments have refused to implement the rules which requires the government to accredit journalists in our country. Even still, when the president negotiated with the civil government that the president would be responsible for accrediting journalists. But as recent as on the 50th anniversary of the press union, the government announced that it's going to resume the accreditation of journalists. And let's speak to the fact that the government is fighting media.
Especially when Mr. Nyasio is saying that news interviews, filming, recording, and photography, you must send in a written approval. It seems to me, with the speed at which news about the Ebola is moving, the government is throwing itself behind.
We can't avoid the truth. We need to get the truth and face the truth and find a solution. The work that journalists are doing, whether in the communities in Bombay or in Calcutta or Tottenham Bird, is not disrupting the response. So the government should be more interested in finding response than fighting journalists.
Abdullahi Kamara is president of the Press Union of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. African Union troops, known as AMISOM, and Somali government forces are preparing to fully take over the strategic town of Barawe today, Monday, after it was recaptured Sunday from the militant group Al-Shabaab following 2 days of fighting. The town had been under Al-Shabaab control since 2008. Former UN official and Horn of Africa analyst Matt Bryden says the recapture of Barawe is a significant loss to Al-Shabaab.
It's significant first symbolically because it was the last major stronghold of Al-Shabaab in southern Somalia. It was also practically of importance because it was a base for planning and staging operations. If you will, it was a headquarters, both for Al-Shabaab and for the leadership of its Kenyan affiliate, Al-Hijra, who were co-located with them in Barawe. But it's also it was also a major source of revenue, one of their last remaining major ports, and a place from which charcoal was exported and commodities were imported for transit trade to neighboring countries and to Mogadishu. So Shabaab has lost not just the symbol of Barawe, but also an operational base and a financial hub.
So how much of a setback this is going to be to Al-Shabaab?
Well, it's a major setback, and it probably marks in some way the transition of Al-Shabaab from what remained of a guerrilla force fighting the AMISOM and forces of the federal government into, again, a largely covert underground network and, to a certain extent, perhaps a residual rural force in parts of southern Somalia. So in that sense, it marks both the end of a phase and possibly the opening of a new phase in the war between Al-Shabaab and the government and its African Union allies.
You talked about the strategic significance of the town. The town recently has become synonymous with the Westgate attack. Explain.
Well, the reporting in the aftermath of Westgate is that the original planning and some of the instructions, the orders to that team came from Brawe. Immediately after Westgate, there was a U.S. airstrike intended to kill one of the presumed planners of the Westgate operation. So Brawe became perhaps infamous as a base of operations in the aftermath of Westgate.
Matt Bryden is a former United Nations official and Horn of Africa analyst. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of VOA's Somali Service. It is Monday morning, October 6th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. A South Sudan official is describing the latest break in the on-and-off-again peace talks between the government and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar as merely a consultative recess. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, known as IGAD, the regional group that has been mediating the talks, had given both sides 45 days from last August to work out details of a transitional government which recognizes President Salva Kiir as president of South Sudan and called on Machar's rebels to nominate someone for the position of prime minister. Foreign Minister Barnaba Merab Benjamin says the break would allow negotiators to consult with their principals on some of the sticking points in the talks.
What has happened is that the negotiators have been asked to go back to their principals to consult on some of the issues where there is some concurrence. Some people seem to agree on certain points, so they will have to go back and consult with the principals, and they will resume on the 15th of this month.
So what are the sticking points that have caused this latest delay? Is it about forming the interim government? Is there disagreement or what?
No, the issue of the interim government is not an issue. The interim government will be formed once you have a political solution. There must be a political agreement so that you have an interim government to implement what has been agreed upon. So there's no problem about the interim government now. In principle, that has been accepted by the government, and there's no question about that. The issue is let us have an agreement. As you remember, we had the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, after which the Government of National Unity was formed. You cannot form an interim government without a political agreement.
The sources quoting your negotiating team in Addis Ababa are saying, I think the disagreement has to do with now the powers of the prime minister and the powers of the presidency. What is the truth here?
Well, if there are those issues, then you need to consult with the principals. It means that they have no problem with the interim government and with the positions of a president or a prime minister. Because as you remember, the protocol which was signed by the IGAD heads of state, including President Salva Kiir Mayardit, had the position of prime minister already in it. So as a government, that was endorsed in the protocol. It was the rebel leader who refused to sign that protocol, in which there is the position of a prime minister. So I think they are going back to consult on some of those issues, the nitty-gritty of what is connected, what the prime minister is to do, and that sort of thing. So really, it is a consultative break. They go and consult with the principals on areas they think that it is the principals who should take decisions on those or be informed in how they could proceed. So I think this is normal in any negotiation.
Mr. Foreign Minister, is it really fair to always blame the rebels, or is the blame on both sides?
No, you cannot blame the government that has signed a protocol which formed the basis for negotiation. It is the rebels who refuse to sign that protocol. It is the rebels who are violating the cessation of hostilities in the ground. And so the government sometimes is blamed because they know it is the constitutional legal authority and they are supposed to lead the process. But I can assure you, facts on the ground indicate rebels have a little bit been very intransigent indeed.
South Sudan's Foreign Minister Barnaba Merab Benjamin was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Reports of violence are on the rise in camps for displaced people in South Sudan's capital, Juba, as VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Jaslow reports. Growing frustration with the ongoing conflict in the country is starting to wear on an already stressed and traumatized population.
10 months after South Sudan erupted into violence stemming from a political dispute between the president and vice president, more than 1.5 million people remain displaced, and according to the United Nations, 4 million are still at risk of hunger. Takuma Kuma is among the tens of thousands who escaped the violence in Juba in December last year by taking shelter at a UN base on the outskirts of town. He describes what he considers the unbearable conditions of the camp, starting with the basic plastic shelter he lives in.
Those things are very hot during daytime. It's just like an oven. You can't go inside and shelter yourself. And if you are there, it's like you're sweating as if you are melting. And during night, very cold. When it rains, it just rains inside.
Originally from Ethiopia, Kuma says he came to South Sudan after being harassed in his home country, accused of belonging to an ethnic Oromo rebel group. But he found that old rivalries among Ethiopians, as well as new tensions with other foreign nationals and South Sudanese, have made him again feel unsafe. At the end of September, the UN says it halted non-essential activities at the Juba camps following a series of attacks on humanitarian staff. The sites have been closed off to journalists this past week. Aid workers have reported recent fighting between residents, continued threats against NGO workers, as well as an assault on a group of visiting photographers. Emmanuel Douglas is the director of the South Sudanese humanitarian organization HealthLink, which is running medical services in the IDP camp at Tom Ping, another UN base in Juba. He says violence was a real problem during the early months of the conflict as people crowded the camp, which became muddy and treacherous during the rainy season. He says a scarcity of resources contributed to rising tensions.
Everybody at that camp is really traumatized. Going in there, seeing what has been happening outside, and being in a very congested place, poor access to services. You can imagine, more than 200 households share a toilet.
Douglas says the Tom Ping camp is quieter now, as most of the residents have been relocated to the base known as UN House. While the rainy season has created misery inside the camps in the past months, it is the coming dry season that now has the UN worried. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Toby Lanzer.
The dry season usually brings added violence, greater hardship, less opportunities for people to fish or farm, and so the outlook right now is terribly bleak.
Lanzer says the international humanitarian response helped prevent a famine in South Sudan this year, but he warns next year could see a particularly harsh lean season. Meantime, renewed fighting in areas contested by the government and rebel militia is compromising humanitarian outreach. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Juba.
More and more Africans these days are communicating via text, social media, and email. In Senegal, literacy experts are using new technologies to motivate and teach women to read. The UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, rolled out the program there in 2012, but is now expanding it to as many as six other African countries. Kristen Roby reports from the suburb of Dakar.
Mariama Dafe is learning to write and work with numbers. She started this at-home study program a year ago at the age of 39. UNESCO partnered with the Ministry of Education to create these literacy modules. They run daily on state television. Some days it's counting, other days it's spelling. The women who are taking part say the lessons have made them more independent.
These days I have my mobile phone and I can read messages and I can send messages too. And I don't have to go to anyone else to give them my mobile phone to read it for me.
Mariama says the lessons are convenient. She fits in three modules a week while also working full-time and taking care of her three kids. Senegal has limited funds for literacy. At-home study programs are cheap and easy to manage. Some women do prefer the classroom. The women here practice in Olof and in French. At least two-thirds of illiterate adults in Senegal are women, but Aistu Keita, who's 39, says it's never too late.
My kids laugh at me. They think it's funny that I started
learning at this age. When I make mistakes, they laugh. But I feel very proud of it, and I have nothing to say.
Instructor Mamadou Diallo says the women love the interactive display wall.
J'étais émerveillé et était pressé de découvrir. Quand je leur disais qu'attendez un peu, il faut qu'on fasse.
The first time they saw it, they were mesmerized and anxious to try it. I told them, wait, first we need to work on the chalkboard before we can start the math. It has been a joy for them to learn how to use new technology.
Une joie pour ces femmes de découvrir vraiment les merveilles de l'informatique.
Mamindak Mboup is treasurer for the classroom business. The women buy food in bulk and sell it for profit. they practice these transactions in the classroom. We started with about $100, and we go to the market. We buy onions in bulk at $1 a kilo, and we sell them for $1.20 a kilo. We keep the profit, and we return the dollar to the group. We keep on doing it. So far, we have earned $700. The classes are free, and the women can come as long as they want. UNESCO is now expanding the program to Kenya, Nigeria, and the Gambia. Kristen Roby for VOA News, Pekin, Senegal.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's portion. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Two-time World Championship marathon gold medalist Edna Kiplagat set a course record of 1 hour, 7 minutes and 57 seconds to lead Caroline Kilel in a 1-2 Kenyan women's triumph at the Bank of Scotland Great Scottish Half Marathon Run in Glasgow, United Kingdom on Sunday. Ethiopian Olympic marathon champion Tiki Gelana was placed third. Meanwhile, South African Stephen Mokoka prevailed in the men's race in 1 hour, 1 minute and 25 seconds. Kenyans Stephen Chemlani and Mark Kipto were second and third, respectively. In Portugal, Kenyan Samuel Ndungu established a new men's course record of 2 hours, 8 minutes and 21 seconds at the Rock and Roll EDP Lisbon Marathon on Sunday. Runner-up Robert Kwambai and Lawrence Kimayo completed the Kenyan sweep of the men's medal podium. Meanwhile, Viseline Jepkesho covered the distance in 2 hours, 26 minutes and 47 seconds to claim the women's title in the new course record. Fellow Kenyan Agnes Kiprop was second ahead of Ethiopian Aslach Masresha. Staying in the Portuguese capital, Kenyan Stephen Kibet won the Rock and Roll Vodafone Half Marathon in 1 hour, 1 minute and 6 seconds. He was followed across the finish line by Ethiopian Monisnet Geremeu and then Ugandan Geoffrey Kusuro. Kenyan Purity Rionoripo won the women's race in 1 hour, 11 minutes and 12 seconds, while Portugal's Sara Moreira was runner-up. In Slovenia, Eritrea's Petro Mamo clocked 41 minutes and 59 seconds to prevail in the men's race at the Smarna Gora Mountain Race near the Slovenian capital Ljubljana on Saturday. With this victory, Mamo sent his total to 366 points in the season mountain running series. He was crowned the men's 2014 World Mountain Running Series champion. Finally, in football, the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations hosts Morocco will host the Central African Republic in a friendly match in Marrakesh today, Monday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. A listener mail for this Monday morning comes from Mohamed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, dear VOA, the upcoming trial of President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya at the International Criminal Court proves that no one is above the law. We thank you, Mohamed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Monday, October 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Manka Oman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very productive week.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked, VOA Africa. Don't miss.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the dry lands of Africa, where poverty and the environment intersect. 60% of sub-Saharan Africa is classified as arid, semi-arid, or sub-humid. Poor soil and drought in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel are annual concerns. That's next time on VOA Africa.